The Department of Anthropology at the University of North Texas is a proud sponsor of the SFAA Podcasting Project. The department offers two master's programs in applied anthropology, an on-campus program and an online program. The online program is the first and only fully online master's in applied anthropology in the United States. More information can be found online at anthropology.unt.edu.
All right, we'd like to, I think, get started here. This is a bit of an odd format, as we've had at a couple of other conferences where we've tried to set up a round table and we've ended up in a room like this, so just bear with us. This entire session, I believe, is being podcast, including any questions that come from the audience, just so that you're aware that that is taking place. This is the roundtable on different fields, common challenges, lessons for and from military anthropology. We're very pleased to bring together today a diverse group of panelists. We tried to select the participants with a broad range of connections to and interests in applied anthropology. We have, moving from my left to my right, Dr. Brian Selmeski from Air University, Dr. Marietta Baba from Michigan State, Dr. Robert Rubenstein from Syracuse University, Dr. Jessica Glicken-Turnley from Galisteo Consulting, and last but not least, Ryle Nolan from Purdue. We're going to ask each participant to spend just a moment or two at the beginning of their remarks to explain a little bit about their connection to applied anthropology and then move into the substance of their discussion. We arranged this around the abstract that you've probably seen, the basic idea being that while military anthropology has been a focus of discussion over the last several years for understandable reasons, it has helped us to identify a number of important questions that have applicability across a range of different kinds of anthropology, whether that's applied, action, advocacy, so forth. It's also a range of different topics of applied anthropology, not just military, but also development, healthcare, business, and other professions. Applying, practicing, and advocating place anthropologists in complex relationships with their employers, with clients, and with research subjects. And we wanted to bring together some people with a variety of different experiences to reflect on how the current focus on anthropological engagement with the military can inform a robust disciplinary discussion about common issues. And we've designed the session to be generative rather than definitive. We didn't ask anybody to write a formal paper on this, but rather just come prepared to reflect on the topic. We gave them some food for thought, you know, asking them to think about the complex relationships, the possibility of responsibility to multiple constituencies that arise in applied anthropology, employment-related bias, issues of secrecy, whether or not we're enabling flawed systems, and things of that sort, but we did not ask them to constrain their remarks to those topics. This issue is simmering along underneath the disciplinary debate and is sure to arise as we start to go through the process of the American Anthropological Association revising the Code of Ethics over the next 2 to 3 years. And the idea behind this panel is not necessarily new, but we thought it was worthwhile to sort of re-engage a little bit on it and see whether or not certain themes would emerge that could be helpful to us as we move forward. Logistically, again, the session is being podcast, and each panelist is going to speak for about 10 to 14 minutes in the following order. Brian Selmeski, Marietta Baba, Ryle Nolan, Jessica Turnley, myself, and then Robert Rubenstein. And that should leave us plenty of time for question and answer at the end, so I would ask that you hold any questions until the end and all panelists have spoken. Thank you very much. Brian?
What Carrie didn't say is that in our tradition of these sorts of workshops, that usually we have very small spaces and very large audiences, so I think we... You know, the joke is on us this time. Ha ha. I'd like to start by talking about how I'm connected to the issues that Carrie just described. The first is that I spent 5 years working for the Canadian military education system. And what I learned along the way, many lessons learned along the way, but one of the most important ones was early on, was looking at the military as a profession, not just as an institution. And this is more than a semantic adjustment. This has all sorts of conceptual linkages that flow from it and implications. So as I was part of this exercise to write the baseline doctrine for the Canadian Forces, treating them as a profession, it led me to two things. First, it shifted how I look at them, if you will. And full disclosure, I was a U.S. Army officer, but when I say them, I mean the military. And the frame of reference shifted from just other organizations to other professions. And that became very important to me as I started what I do now, which is working on teaching culture to militaries. Because I decided that rather than starting by looking at what all the other militaries around the world were doing, I might want to start by looking at what other professions were doing. So I looked at what the, and I hyphenated some of these because the literatures are somewhat disparate, at what development and diplomacy are doing, what medical and health services are doing, the educational profession, and business, particularly international business. I think you'll see some of the similar approaches being taken on this panel. The second thing that working on the Profession of Arms Project in Canada taught me to think about was us, or me. And if you were in Memphis last year, you maybe had to sit through my paper on dual professional theory. And in a nutshell, that is this idea that when you serve two professions or two institutions, you have multiple standards and expectations and responsibilities. Well, my argument was that this is a quintessentially applied anthropological dilemma. And while not all military anthropologists are applied anthropologists, I think some of the challenges that applied anthropologists as a whole face are common to those who work with the military. The second way I connect to this panel is that when I look at the discourse within the discipline of anthropology around working with the military, engaging with the military, and there's been a fair bit of exchange, I pull two salient elements from that that I want to work to counter. The first is a flattening of the discourse, that is, what's being done by anthropologists within the military. And that's not necessarily the focus of today, but in the past we've emphasized the variety, the diversity of ways that anthropologists work with the military. The second is a narrowing of the discourse, and that is what aspects are of concern. Now, those two come together in a peculiarly political and emotional way when we begin talking about the human terrain system. And what I'd like to do is to say that discourse is important. It's not the one that I think we're trying to push forward right now. To decenter that slightly lets us pick up on some of this comparative exchange and analysis between other professions, between other forms of applied anthropology. So that's the why. My points on the lessons from military anthropology can only be drawn from my small corner, my relatively circumscribed place within a much larger effort. I work at an accredited university. I am a professor there. What I do is some ways similar and some ways dissimilar to anybody who works in a university setting. So I cannot reflect all of military anthropology. I want to be very clear up front that I will speak to my experiences, and they're fairly diverse. But that's where they're coming from. They're not representative. With that caveat, I have 5 points. I don't know if they're lessons per se, but 5 points to put out to you for further contemplation discussion. The first is exceptionalism. The second is change and structures. The third is tension. The fourth is responsibility. And the fifth is what guides our action? Exceptionalism. I do not see military anthropology, as is probably clear by now from my introduction, as exceptional when compared to other forms or types of anthropology, particularly applied anthropology. I think that many of the challenges that I face are standard academic classroom challenges. They are, however, cast into high relief because of where I work and with whom I work. At other times, the challenges that I face are very similar to those of an applied anthropologist working in, say, the medical or business or development fields. Those differences and similarities become much more obvious if we stop with the narrowing of the discourse. So my first point is just that if we broaden, that the exceptionalism, which drives, I believe, part of the way our discourse has been very, very restricted within anthropology, we can work around that. Second is change. Now, we can change a lot of things. We can change people's attitudes. We can change their knowledge. I'm going to focus on changing structure. Working within the military, it is a bureaucracy. It is a particularly structured organization or profession. And I will tell you that change is possible. However, ensuring that that change to the structure is sustainable is difficult. It's much more difficult than changing structure. I think that I start with the elements required for this with people. That great Margaret Mead quote about never underestimating a small group of dedicated people who can make change. There is a small group of dedicated people working to make change. The second requirement to make that change and make it sustainable, though, is that it has support from the base. And I think this is a lesson that I learned from applied anthropology, not necessarily bring to share today, and that is when what I am teaching resonates with students, be they professional students or liberal arts students, it is a much easier sell to keep that in the curriculum. The third, however, because it is such a highly structured organization, is leadership from the top. And I will tell you my personal experience. I feel blessed to have multiple ranks of general officers who are supportive and encouraging this. Now, either from the bottom or from the top is a perfectly good approach. I think to make it sustainable, we do need to address both of those. Financial resources. I'm proud to say that I spent more of your tax dollars on buying anthropological literature for the Air University Library than probably any other person. Perhaps more of your tax dollars buying anthropological literature for DOD. But to get that funding base is an absolutely essential requirement to not just getting a couple courses into the curriculum, but to making a program of change and making it stick. And finally, institutionalizing this, by which I mean creating requirements. Militaries, as largely structured organizations, are requirements-driven. Now, doing so is going to require some compromises. And this is where I think the Society for Applied Anthropology meetings are much more welcoming of my perspective here, because I know what ideal looks like to me. And while you all may have a different vision of that, I also know that I will never reach ideal because I work within an institution that has some very clear limitations. Now, I have lines that I will not cross. However, I think we all make these compromises whenever we do applied work. But the military is not organic. It's an institution, and it's composed of individuals. So I have to work through individuals and with individuals, cognizant of the fact that I'm in a structure. And to do that, I have had to basically forsake most of my teaching responsibilities and spend time as an administrator. And that's an incredibly disappointing and yet rewarding decision. It's reflective of this third point, though, the tensions. The other tensions I would point out is that dual professional tension that I spoke about last year. Am I a bureaucrat? Am I an academic? Also, am I an anthropologist or am I a social scientist, since I work in an interdisciplinary environment? I will say that so long as we see these tensions as limitations, that we are selling ourselves short. And I have struggled for the past 16 months at Air University to think about the power of liminality. What do I celebrate because I'm somewhat liminal, rather than what do I lament because I gave it up? And I think about this on about a weekly basis. Occasionally, I find, wow, there's an opportunity to do tremendous things here that I couldn't do at a civilian university, and that offsets what I could do if I were at a civilian university because I couldn't do a lot of the things that I really do cherish. The tension is often a result of my fourth point, and that is the responsibilities to multiple parties. I break these into two broad categories. Responsibilities to the state, or specifically the military. It is an institution of the state. And yes, there is that institutional element. I must work for the Air Force and for the Department of Defense. But I also, coming back to those individuals, most of what I do is not because I believe that the Air Force is a particularly sanctified institution. It's because the members of the institution have asked me for help. And it has a moral responsibility for me that comes with that. When you are asked for help, how do you respond? On the other side, I have a responsibility to the discipline and to science, both to anthropology, which is why I keep coming to AAA and SFAA and trying to engage and listening and speaking, but also to you as colleagues. My takeaway here, though, is that the real underlying core issue for responsibility to the military is that they're interested in utility. I work in a professional organization. I work in a professional educational institution. And professional education is concerned with utility, whereas science as a whole is not predicated on utility. It is oftentimes more concerned with our scientific credibility. To wrap up, why do we do this? Our actions, what are they guided by? Carrie had mentioned that we'd ask people to reflect on doing no harm. And I will say that doing no harm would lead me to disengage from the military if I applied a strict biomedical ethical perspective. However, given all of the other things I talked about, the opportunity to do good is, I believe, paramount in what I choose to do. That requires engagement, not blind engagement. And let me just wrap up by saying that all forms of engagement, whether they be protest or whether they be teaching the military, I believe have different merits. So if we, that goes back to my deepening of the disciplinary discourse, as we do that, we can begin to see the relative pros and cons of different ways of engaging. So to conclude, what is the way ahead? I hate what I've written here because it sounds so pedantic, but I'm going to just quickly summarize it because I think it's important for us to say it out loud. We need to use our disciplinary concepts and methods to chart our way forward. Comparative, ethnographic, concerned with validity, questioning taken for granted assumptions, practicing relativism, and being holistic. We tell our students to do that every day. As we engage in our disciplinary discourse, we need to practice what we preach. I hope that this small gathering is one step towards doing that. Thanks.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Marietta Baba. I'm a professor of anthropology and dean of the College of Social Science at Michigan State University. I'm going to situate myself in this discussion by hearkening back to a scenario that took place over 20 years ago at the meetings of the American Anthropological Association. An uproar over a similar kind of situation, but from a different sector. At that time, I was the president of the National Association for the Practice of Anthropology, and I was trying to encourage colleagues to come to the meetings and set up sessions that would focus on the practice of business, the practice of anthropology in business, and to actually bring with them people from business to discuss what anthropologists might be doing in business. And I was approached by the president of the American Anthropological Association, who told me that the executive board had received a petition to ban all sessions dealing with the practice of business from the AAA. Now, it's quite interesting how that was handled at the time. There were no commissions established to investigate this petition. I was not allowed to see the petition, nor was I asked to come and speak to the executive board. The executive board made a decision without any discussion. And the decision that they made was this petition was out of order because it violated academic freedom. Some colleagues might object to there being sessions on business, but they couldn't stop other colleagues from investigating that or stop their speech rights. So the sessions continued. Now, I think it's interesting to compare that to what's happening now. There were some contextual differences. One of the contextual differences was, at that time, we still had the biennial surveys of PhD graduates in anthropology, which we no longer have. And in 1986, 42% of new PhD graduates were leaving academe and going either into business or government. And in 1988, that number went up to 54%. Whereas now, if you look at the CIRG, C-I-R-G, study of graduates 10 years out from the PhD, you find out that only 12% are leaving academia and going into either government or business. That doesn't mean the rest of them have tenure-track jobs in academia. A minority do, but the rest are hanging around in non-tenure-track jobs. CIRG is a research institute at the University of Washington in Seattle. The Anthropological Association no longer keeps these numbers, so we're not really sure what happens to our graduates. But there are fewer of them making us worried about what's happening to the future of our discipline. There was also the intent to not make too big of a fuss out of this and kind of keep things quiet and hope that it would go away, which it did. It went away. And now there are many, many anthropologists working in businesses, for better or for worse, all over the globe. There are thousands of them. And you don't hear any more, there are no more issues about it. There are many sessions on anthropologists working in business. It's commonplace. In fact, they have their own global conference called Ethnographic Praxis in Industry. Ethnographic Praxis, yes, Praxis in Industry. It met in Europe last year. Hundreds of anthropologists attend that conference. So the things that are controversial change in context and in time. Now there's controversy over anthropologists working in security, intelligence, and military contexts. It's a different time. It's a different controversy. I found that it was interesting, the decision rule that was used by the executive board to allow the business anthropologist to continue. The decision rule was academic freedom. This was a decision rule that came out of the profession that serves the discipline of anthropology. This got me to thinking about the difference between discipline and profession. We're quite accustomed to using these terms interchangeably, the discipline of anthropology, the profession of anthropology. We think of them as pretty much the same thing. But if you study the history of the two terms and the constructs themselves and their meanings, they're quite different. They evolve differently through the Middle Ages, and they have very different places in our language. The term discipline, I ask you just to bear with me for a minute here. The term discipline means a body of knowledges and a course of instruction or exercises that are taught to novices to mold their mental and moral character. While a profession, on the other hand, is a promise or a vow that one takes to show that they have the knowledge and skills to offer to others that will therefore allow them to earn a livelihood. Now, one particular kind of profession, a vow that I take to state that I have knowledge and skill that allows me to earn a livelihood, is the profession of being a professor. I'm dedicated to furthering the interests of the discipline of anthropology. That's one kind of profession. It so happens that the profession of the discipline of anthropology is the predominant and most powerful profession of anthropology that exists. But there are many other professions of anthropology in addition to that one. They are not strong in numbers, and they are not as well known. But in most other fields, there are non-professorial professions that are quite large and prominent. So, for example, if you went into fields such as theology or chemistry or psychology or economics, you would find both the professions that are dedicated to the discipline and you'd find the professions that are dedicated to the service of others. And they would all be prominent and have their roles. Somehow in anthropology, when we don't have time to go into this today, the profession that's dedicated to the advancement of the discipline has become the most prominent and powerful, both with respect to numbers, visibility, voice, placement, and everything that goes with it. And the other professions that are dedicated to the service of others are much smaller and less prominent and powerful. Now, I think that's a very important point. If we think about what just happened last year with respect to the American Anthropological Association disapproving of anthropologists working in the human terrain teams and human terrain systems. Without saying that I either approve or disapprove of that, because I think we simply don't know enough about it, and I don't think we knew enough about it then, and I think we still don't know enough about it, I believe that that decision was made in accordance with the thinking, the logic, and the standards of the profession that serves the discipline of anthropology. And I believe that that profession took its guidelines for research, ethics, and applied them like rules with very little information to another profession that it knew very little about. There were five reasons why the American Anthropological Association Executive Board stated that anthropologists could not work on the human terrain teams, human terrain systems. And three of those five reasons pertained to Section 3 of the Code of Ethics, all of which are related to research ethics. There isn't time today to go in great detail, but one of them pertained to the anthropologist's primary obligation to the people they study. One of them pertained to not gaining voluntary informed consent. And one of them pertained to identifying and selecting specific populations as targets. All three of these stipulations assume the classic research dyad of the disciplinary-oriented anthropologist in a research setting, where there are certain freedoms and constraints that disciplinary-oriented anthropologists have. If, on the other hand, you have spent many years as a researcher in a non-disciplinary-oriented mode of research or consulting, you will find that this model does not hold. I have a few pages here where I give examples of how the simple dyad, what I mean is researcher and research participant, or researcher and research subject, is a very simple model that doesn't apply to situations where there is a third party, such as a client or a sponsor, that the anthropologist also has obligations to. Things become very complicated in a hurry. And these requirements that are encoded within the AAA Code of Ethics Section 3 do not strictly and easily apply. And if you've done any applied work, you know that. And the code is not meant to apply to you as a set of rules. It says within the code, these are guidelines for you to look at and to think through with your peers what are the correct steps to take to prevent ethical dilemmas that are to the detriment of your research participants. And I won't go through all the details here because it will take up too much time. In the case of the HTT-HTS, this advice was not used. Instead, it was said, you may not work in this field of practice. We are going to take away from you the ability to implement this code as a set of guidelines, and we are going to apply a rule. You may not do this work, even though we don't really know what you're doing. In other words, we had a disciplinary-oriented body, the executive board of the AAA, who are mainly discipline-oriented professionals, not completely, but primarily, telling a mainly non-disciplinary-oriented professional group that it was using its code of ethics not as a guideline but as a rule to stop their practice. I am raising this as an issue which I believe is not only unfair but moving in a direction that is not appropriate, particularly because the American Anthropological Association has now decided it's going to revise its entire code of ethics with this kind of thinking in mind. The same kind of restrictions they have placed on the HTT-HTS anthropologists could now be placed on any anthropologist working outside of the classic model of the research dyad of discipline-oriented professionals. That could be any applied anthropologist working in a triadic situation. Now, you might ask yourself, why are they doing this? What's the point? It's happened before, and the reason is politics. Some members of the American Anthropological Association don't like the political context of practice. And so what they are doing is they are stopping the practice from happening in that context. And I do not believe that that is an appropriate use of a code of ethics. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Ryle Nolan. I'm an associate provost and dean of international programs at Purdue University, and I'm also a development anthropologist, which I think is what brings me here today. I started thinking about this by asking myself what I called three framing questions, and one of them was inspired by something that Meta wrote and sent to all of us a month or so ago. And it's the simple question, is it acceptable and possible to work within flawed institutions? That's the first question. The second question is, are we, to lift a phrase from somebody else's writing, are we tools of oppression? How different or similar are we from chaplains, doctors, or journalists who work in war zones? How different are we from the civilian truckers who transport war material to the front or from those who manufacture guns and ammunition in our own country? And the final framing question that I asked myself is the one that I really want to talk about, which is what should anthropology be doing about what I call the grand challenges of our time? I think the first of the framing questions is the easiest to answer. Yes, it's not only okay to work with flaws and flawed institutions, it's essential. In my case, you've got to understand that I always believed in what Karl Marx said, that the whole point of understanding the world was in order to be able to change it. In my office, I have a poster from the 1960s, which shows Marx, Engels, and Lenin. And in German, it says, Alle reden vom Wetter, wir nicht, which means everybody talks about the weather, but not us. And that's kind of my creed. I know that a lot of my colleagues might disagree with that, and that's okay. I respect that. But that's me. That's what I believe. And that's what got me into practicing anthropology in the first place. So are we tools of oppression? No, I don't think so. I do think, however, that many of the circumstances under which we work as practitioners are fundamentally different from those which govern and inform academic lives. And Meta touched on this, and I want to elaborate on it a little bit. First of all, we don't have simple dyadic relationships in the field. We have clients, not informants, and they are rarely little people. We have many stakeholders, and it is impossible to completely satisfy them all. And we often cannot simply balance these concerns. We must choose one over the other. Secondly, we work on significant problems which affect many people. Some of the things we work on are what I call grand challenges. Poverty is one of these, and I think so is national security. Donald Schoen, who wrote The Reflective Practitioner, once described the topography of all this as looking like a very messy swamp with a dry knoll poking out of the middle of it. On the knoll, a very few people work on problems in a very theoretical, clean, and abstract way. But down in the swamp, there are a great many other people, and their work there isn't nearly as clean or even as clear. It's messy, it's disjointed, and it's hard. But it's also where the grand challenges lie. Thirdly, we don't just provide criticism and advice. We actually plan and manage things. And what we do often has an immediate, as opposed to an eventual, probable, or possible effect on people's lives. Finally, as somebody has said before, we are never outside the context of what we do. What we do is hardly ever value neutral, and there is very little that is objective in the process. So what can development teach us? What have I got to say to you from 20 years of work as a development anthropologist? Well, first of all, I think, like warfare, development work is very much concerned with matters of content, budgets, technical specifications, procedures, deadlines, and policies. But success in the field depends far more on context than anything else, that is, on the extent to which the cultural assumptions embedded in our work actually fit with those operating in the local environment. McFate has noted that this cultural element is largely missing in most of the military's work, and the same is true, I am very sorry to say, for development work. In that sense, therefore, development isn't about us as anthropologists. It's about us in relation to a much wider group of people. It's about infusing institutions and organizations with our perspective. If we can do this, it will work. To paraphrase Aldous Huxley, I mean, once you get those doors of perception open, it's very hard to get them shut again. But on the other side of this, we must acknowledge and accept a fundamental loss of control over what our colleagues do with what we enable them to see and understand. The potential for abuse of cultural knowledge certainly exists in nearly all areas where cultures encounter one another, not just on the battlefield. We can't be effective at getting our perspective across without what I term going inside. We cannot understand or influence or change the development outcomes we get unless we understand the development industry. And we cannot understand the development industry by remaining outside it and aloof from its operation and concerns any more than we could understand a society on the other side of the world from the comfort and security of our living rooms. And yes, there will always be ethical issues. We will always have the dirty hands, guilty knowledge problem that Fetterman referred to years ago. Let me just mention two of these that I have written about quite a bit in the past that affect development anthropologists. One I call collusion, and the other is about knowing where the bodies are buried. Collusion refers to our willing participation in a complex system of bilateral and multilateral charades, otherwise referred to as the development game. The players in which are locked into a symbiotic relationship, the primary aim of which is to keep the money flowing. Everyone who has ever been a part of this recognizes the corrupt and collusive nature of this operation. The second problem, where the bodies are buried, refers to truth-telling. There is no natural constituency for development work in this country, but there is a strong anti-government bias among large sections of the U.S. population. At the same time, as I indicated, there is a strong and not very public establishment running the foreign aid game. We therefore face a deep and fundamental dilemma. If we talk frankly and fully about what we know and about how things work, we may either dry up our own access to that industry or horrify the public on whose support the effort to reform development ultimately depends, or both. So, is the game worth it? Or should we just turn our backs, give up, and devote ourselves to cleaner pursuits? Should we, in Donald Schoen's terms, climb up out of the swamp and sit peacefully up on the dry knoll? I think you all know what my answer has got to be. Poverty, in my view, is one of the most important grand challenges of our time. And it is, I think you would agree, connected at some basic level to a broader and deeper issue of national security. We can't not be involved with these issues. The ethicist Peter Singer reminds us the value of a human life does not diminish when we cross national boundaries. What obligations, he goes on to ask, do affluent people have in a world in which more than a billion people live in extreme poverty? I think there are many different ways to engage with these issues, many different ways to make a contribution as a person, as a citizen, or as an anthropologist. And we need to recognize and acknowledge that different people are going to do this in different ways. What's clear to me from my work with development is that anthropology opens eyes. People who think the way anthropologists do are more critical, more open to new data, and better able to make sense of what's around them. And if intelligence is the ability to make finer, significant discriminations, then anthropology makes most people smarter. So what would a culturally aware military look like? What would a culturally aware development industry look like? Isn't that something worth trying to do, as messy and as difficult as it might be? Shouldn't we use what we know to make everyone a little smarter, even if we have to accept that in the process we don't get to tell them what to do with what they know? So here are some final thoughts to conclude with. First, we need to get out more. We need to engage with the world's grand challenges. Let other people talk about the weather, not us. If we stay within the walls of the university and we talk mainly to students and to each other, we never really have to confront issues involving the application of what we know. Secondly, I think we need to change our thinking about ourselves. Some years ago, I got interested in the subject of development narratives. That is, of the stories we tell one another to help us shape our thinking and that of others about things out in the developing world. Like myths and like fairy tales, development narratives draw our attention to salient aspects of that world, but they also enable us to avoid thinking too deeply about things. We have such narratives embedded in our ethics talk in anthropology, too, in particular, seem significant in the debate about anthropology's involvement with power. One narrative, of course, is that we have always been dirty. We all know this story very well. It's been drummed into us for decades. The second narrative is somewhat more attractive, at least to some people. It is that, well, we might be dirty now, but at one point in the past, we were clean. Both narratives insist, however, that it is now time for us to become clean. I can't help but feel that both of these narratives are profoundly unhelpful to us, both as a discipline and as a profession, as we grapple with the realities of our century. Many of us, even today, are still debating whether or not to get involved with the world rather than learning about how to do it well. Worse yet, some of us have decided not to, and they want to keep the rest of us from engaging too. Well, as Charlton Heston might have said, over my cold, dead body. I am still a practicing anthropologist, and I am proud of it. I am still proud that I spent the first half of my career down in the swamp, wet and dirty as hell, trying to make a difference. Trying, as Karl Marx would have said, not just to understand the world, but to change it. And today, I'm still trying to change things. I work at Purdue, and my job is to get students off campus and into those intercultural engagements that will perhaps open their own eyes a little and give them something to talk about other than the weather. I work especially hard with the engineers, the folks who might turn into Homer Atkins, the original ugly American. You remember Homer Atkins? Homer was the engineer who lived in the village, spoke the language, ate the local food, and he made a difference in people's lives. So for me, that's where the payoff is, with folks like Homer. Engineers get the grand challenges. They're eager to get started on them. Trying to teach engineers to think more like anthropologists as they tackle those grand challenges is a lot more satisfying, I've found, than trying to get anthropologists to engage with the grand challenges at all. The anthropological experience with engagement, at least as far as development is concerned, has not been a particularly happy one. It has left some of us disillusioned, some of us confused, and others traumatized. In our confusion, our hurt, or our anger, we in the discipline sometimes react by wanting to make rules for others, to define no-fly zones and impose them on everybody else. This makes about as much sense to me as trying to raise your children out of a rule book rather than focusing on giving those children the ability to make decisions for themselves. Not every child will make wise decisions. Some of the children will not only hurt themselves, but they may occasionally hurt others. But this does not and should not call into question the principle that each child has within itself the capacity and indeed the obligation to become a responsible adult. And it requires us, as the song says, to teach your children well, even though, as we well know, they will sometimes make us cry. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jessica Glicken-Turnley, and I just realized as we were all being introduced up here that I think I'm the only one up here that does not have university after my name right now. I run a consulting business in Albuquerque, just down the road here, so I didn't have to get on an airplane to come, which is wonderful. Since I got my degree in 1983, I have never held a full-time appointment at a university. I've had adjunct and teaching positions, but I have never been sort of primarily designed or primarily identified as an academic anthropologist. And so for me, this whole conversation has been a very interesting one about what does it mean to be an anthropologist? And as a result, I think my talk is going to be a little bit different also than some of the ones you've heard before. I want to talk, I'm actually going to pick up on some of the themes that Marietta raised on these questions of identity and the, our different selves that we play out in the practice of whatever it is that we do. She spoke of disciplinary and professional selves. And I'm going to add a third self to that, which is what I call the self as citizen in the broadest sense of that word, which means as an engaged participant in a social community, whatever that might be. And what I'm going to do now for the next few minutes is give you some examples of, I've had many different lives, of some of the lives that I've lived and the ways in which those three different roles have played out. And I'll bring it back at the end to this, the more direct topic that we're talking about here with the military or national security anthropology. So I want to start with an example of my role as founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization here in New Mexico called WestCorp. WestCorp is an organization designed to help women start and run businesses. It was and is, because it's still ongoing, a classic microeconomic development project. We provided consulting and training to disadvantaged and low-income populations. And this was, 10, 15 years ago? I established and began operating a microloan fund, which was a new thing back then. And boy, did I learn a lot setting that thing up. As part of my startup efforts for WestCorp, I wrote a business plan, a formal business plan, which involved assessing the state of women-owned businesses both nationally and here in New Mexico. Because of my anthropological background, I saw the problem for many women as one of entering and managing within a new cultural environment. Entering into business ownership requires acquisition for many of a new vocabulary, of new ways of conceptualizing activity, and perhaps most importantly, the adoption of a whole new set of values. To complicate matters, in New Mexico, as you probably already know, we have a tricultural population. Notions regarding things like obligations to family, attitudes towards debt, work ethic, and the like, all impact business success, and all very significantly, and let me point out, not just amongst Anglos, Hispanics, and Native Americans, our sort of three major populations, but also among tribes, and also between Hispanics and Mexicanos, and also between the Anglos who work at the national labs and the Anglos who run dry cleaners. So there is a huge amount of this kind of cultural variation within the population I was targeting. Just as a short little example, when I set up an outreach program in Taos, just up the road here, I was told by the local community there I had to run three separate introductory meetings within the community, one for the Pueblo, one for the Hispanics, and one for the Anglos. Why? Well, because of the Pueblo Revolt. Well, the Pueblo Revolt was in 1680. It was led by a Tauceno, and it brought the Pueblos together to kick out the Spanish, who were currently the colonizing power here in the territory. They still remember those divisions in Taos. They still will not come together in the same room. It is alive and well. All right? So just as a little side note, when we worry about things like, you know, centuries-old conflicts in Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, we got it right here in River City. All right. So with all these kinds of things at play, I ended up writing a business plan that followed all the rules for a B-school business plan, right? I had, you know, mission, vision, market analysis, product definition, I mean, all these kinds of things, financials. But I also addressed all the peculiar cultural tensions of being a woman starting a business in New Mexico. Did my anthropology background and perspective help with that? Absolutely. And then, what was my role as the founder and executive director of a nonprofit? It was directly and explicitly to act as an advocate for the clients that I served by creating an organization that would provide services I believe necessary and raising the money to provide them and to pay my own salary, by the way, if you've ever run a nonprofit. I personally believed that this was a community in need and made the personal choice to help. Now, I would argue that you could disagree with my determination that this was a community in need, and that is a disagreement that you take on with me as a citizen, as an engaged member of this community. You could also argue with the way I set up and ran the organization. That would be a disagreement with me, I would propose, in a slightly different way than you're using the term, as a professional, all right? The way I ran the business. Finally, you could take issue with the way in which I framed the problem, the data I collected to support it, and the conclusions I drew about some of the difficulties that women in New Mexico face starting businesses. And it is there, I think, that you could argue with me as an anthropologist. All right? So those are three separate selves that were at play there. Another example. I did some work on the safety culture at Intel Corporation's large manufacturing plant down there near Albuquerque. They employ about 5,000 or 6,000 people. Company managers wanted to improve their what's called a reportable incident rate, which is the number of accidents they have on the shop floor, and believed they were implementing procedures and programs that should have worked, but they weren't. My project there involved a combination of archival research on company data, focus groups and interviews with company employees, and some minimal participant observation on site. For a variety of reasons, some of the data I reviewed was company proprietary because Intel believed it could negatively impact its market position, or actually could impact its market position if it was publicly revealed. I was required to sign a non-disclosure, stating that if I did release the data, I would be subject to certain strict legal sanctions, including fines and imprisonment, which, by the way, are comparable to the sanctions for revealing classified data. I sign these things also when I work with startup companies. This is not atypical if you work in the private sector. In some cases, corporate contracts, depending upon the nature of the project, anything written about the company must be approved in advance before it's disseminated. I offer that courtesy to my clients all the time anyway. Every respondent with whom I interacted at Intel was made aware of the nature of my project and knew to whom I was reporting. In the focus groups, I was able to ensure participants that while management would know who was in the room, there would be anonymity with regard to specific statements. With the interviews, all responses were aggregated unless I received specific approval from particular respondents to do otherwise. The results from this project revealed that management and employees had two very different mental models of safety and safe behavior, which drove different behavioral regimes in the workplace. Until these were reconciled, management would continue to put in place programs which employees would subvert, not deliberately, but because they had, again, these different mental models that drove different kinds of behavior. The group I was working with attacked this problem, were able to achieve a somewhat closer congruence in conceptions of safety in the workplace, and the year following our project, reportable incidents did drop. So let's look again at these three categories of persona. As a citizen, I believe making workplaces safer is a good thing to do. You could hypothetically argue that Intel's not an ethical corporation for a variety of reasons. I'm not arguing that. I'm saying it's a hypothetical and that I shouldn't engage with it. But given that Intel exists and it's not likely to go away tomorrow, I believe making its workplace safer is a good thing to do. The agreement and willingness to work for the corporation did not preclude me from attacking the larger problem of Intel's corporate ethics, if I thought there was a problem with that, in other forums, nor did it bar me from reporting any illegal activity had I run across any, which I did not. So that was a decision I made as a citizen to help make workplaces safer. As a professional, you could challenge the way in which I engage with them in terms of my contract and my demeanor, et cetera. And as an anthropologist, you could take issue with the research design and execution. It's important to note that my role here was different than it was at Westcorp. Here I was a researcher, not an advocate. I believe that the first step to improve workplace safety was a better understanding of how people conceptualized and moved through the work environment. Once we had that understanding, then management could develop programs that would leverage it, and I could make another choice about my willingness to engage with those programs and then act as an advocate for them in the workplace. In this case, I was acting as a researcher. I want to stress that in my role as a researcher in a corporate environment, I always make it very clear to my clients that I do not know the outcome of the research before we start. And it may, in fact, be antithetical to what they're looking for. I always say that explicitly. I will not construct a research design that will elicit predetermined answers or positions from respondents. My job is one of discovery, not advocacy, when I am working as a researcher. Only once did I get involved in a project where it became clear after the fact that the management decision had been made before the research was undertaken, and I have since refused to do any further work for that company. All right, so that was my ethical position on that. Finally, the question at hand. I do currently work for the Department of Defense, as well as for various military services and some of the component commands. I also work for other organizations involved in national security. My work is generally of two kinds. One part involves gaining a better understanding of the community itself, the anthropology of the U.S. military. In this role, I generally act as researcher and give my clients the same caveat I give my private sector clients. I may find out things that you don't like about your organization. My role is one of discovery. The other part involves making contributions in various ways, not just teaching, to developing cultural knowledge amongst members of those of the military in various kinds of ways. Here I do come from an advocacy position, for I believe that greater cultural sensitivity in any human being anywhere can only lead to better judgments and decisions and ultimately a better world. The military services and the DOD are highly complex organizations composed of both uniform and civilian personnel. They shape the world we all live in very real ways, whether we like that or not. I also believe they perform a necessary function of a state, a function which is part of the way in which a state draws its conceptual as well as real borders. How that function is being discharged is a different question, all right? As a citizen, I disagree with many of the things that DOD and the military are doing today. However, since I believe the function is a necessary function of the state, as a citizen, I've chosen to make a decision to engage with it and hope, again, to make some small changes and improvements in it. This does not preclude me from, as with Intel, from challenging or critiquing the institution in other forums or from reporting any illegal activity I may encounter. You can differ with my positions on these points, and I suspect many people here do. But our differences are differences as citizens. They're political differences, and that's fine. Again, you can challenge the way in which I conduct my business, put contracts in place, and et cetera. That you would challenge me as a professional. And finally, you can challenge the design and execution of any research I do, including whether or not I harm my research subjects, which, by the way, are the members of the U.S. military. All right? And that's where you challenge me as an anthropologist. Okay, I will leave you with just two final thoughts. First, and this is, to me, is very important, I strongly believe, that it's disciplinarily irresponsible, that is irresponsible of us as anthropologists, to ignore a sociocultural institution that is as world-shaping as the U.S. military because we have disagreements with particular decisions made by particular people at a particular point in time. That doesn't discount the importance of the institution or the function. Second, I would submit to you that the reduction in fear of the strange and unknown that enhanced cultural awareness can bring can only benefit all of us, whether that lessening of fear take place in a Marine gunny sergeant or a military planner or a college freshman in the heartland of the U.S. Thank you.
I was reflecting as I was sitting back there that I, at this point in my life, routinely have discussions with high-level DOD employees. I argue nearly daily with senior Marine NCOs and officers who are strong personalities, believe me. And I do that without having very much of an issue with it, and I come here and I get nervous. Every time I speak in front of an anthropological audience, I get nervous. And my voice shakes. So I guess that says something about where my priorities are, which is good. But I'm Carrie Fosher, and I work for Marine Corps Intelligence Activity, so there is actually, you're not completely alone. I don't have university back there. In that role, I work to shape the command's overall approach to culture. I teach analysts, civilians, and Marines. So I've got a pretty broad swath of policy work, teaching, and other kinds of applications that I do. I previously encountered applied anthropology while I was doing work on domestic preparedness in New England, mostly cops, firefighters, looking at community health preparedness, and things that are relatively, I think, routine for applied anthropology. It's just that now what I do seems to be a little bit more interesting to people. There were a lot of different topics. Oh, sorry, that reminds me. Particularly because this is being podcast, I have to say that what I am about to say has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on the position of the Marine Corps or any other organization in the U.S. government, although that's usually clear once I start talking. There are a lot of different topics I would have liked to talk about in this roundtable. In the interest of time, I chose three. Over the last few years, I, like most military anthropologists, have had to speak about ethics more than anybody ever should have to. And I will talk a little bit about that today. But there are two other challenges highlighted in the current debate that I wanted to at least touch on, because they're shared across all applied anthropology, I think, and also to some degree advocacy. These are issues of role and positionality and the issue of disciplinary conventions that may make it a little bit difficult for us to communicate our decision-making processes and the knowledge that we build across the applied academic divide. As you're going to be able to tell from what I say, I absolutely accept the fact that applied anthropology produces a lot of information that is incredibly valuable to the broader discipline, not just knowledge, but also theory building and critique. it's just a matter of trying to figure out ways to bring that together that work for everybody. But first, ethics. We'll get it over with. Questions of ethics and bias have been hallmarks of the discipline's discussion of anthropology in the security sector. And I'm quite sure that most applied anthropologists conduct their work in full accordance with AAA and SFAA codes of ethics. But the discipline does not necessarily see the ethical decision-making process of applied anthropologists in the same way that they see that that ethical decision-making process in academic work. I wouldn't necessarily want any other applied anthropologist to have to go through what we're going through right now in terms of dealing with that issue, but it does yield some lessons. And I think that's that those of us working in this kind of a position end up having to be able to quickly and professionally convey both our actual decisions that we have made, but also the way that we came about making those decisions and the frameworks in which we made those decisions. It's not enough for us to just spout some platitudes about mitigating harm and move on. It's not enough to say what we have decided. We have to explain how we arrived at that decision. That means spending time understanding the nuances of the critique that we're engaging in. For example, how do we continually sort through issues of bias, of secrecy, of the potential impacts on the discipline, issues of enabling flawed systems, and the potential pressures that could lead us to unacceptable compromises? We also have to address the issue of the frames in which those decisions are reached, and I think that this is something that really hasn't gotten a lot of attention, and we need to start paying attention. For example, I accept a lot of the critiques made by people like David Price and Roberto Gonzalez about military anthropology, but I don't accept that as the only possible frame in which I can make my decisions. There seems to be largely a structural determinist macro-level argument. Most of the decisions that I make tend to happen within a framework that's more focused on human agency and more focused on micro-level discussions. I've written this before, so I won't belabor it, but I believe that the lives that are currently being lived in conflicts matter, and I don't believe that I have the luxury of ignoring those in pursuit of some larger disciplinary or ethical goal. So I think the lesson here is the clear articulation of ethical choices, ethical decision-making process, and the frames in which we reach those decisions. Academic anthropologists do have reason to be concerned. I mean, historically, there are reasons to be concerned about what we're doing, and so this ability to really be very clear with people about what we're doing is important. Next comment, where are we with time? Okay. Next comment is something where I think military anthropologists have a lot to learn about from others in the applied world. Positionality and role clarity are really significant, and I think some of the other speakers have touched on that. At what point do you stop being an anthropologist and start being something else, an advisor, an analyst, a bureaucrat, who just happens to be using a social science background? There are lots and lots of anthropologists working in DOD and the intelligence community who have a PhD in anthropology, but long ago they accepted a different professional role as their primary identity. And some of them are rediscovering their possible identity as an anthropologist, and that raises a lot of issues about, you know, what ground are you standing on. This has been particularly highlighted in the disciplines debate for anthropologists who are deploying. Are they conducting research? If so, are they following federal law on IRB and abiding by the code of ethics of whatever association they belong to? If one or both of those things isn't true, should they be self-identifying as researchers and anthropologists? Could doing so confuse their colleagues about the limitations on research or cause problems for scholars later in the field? For example, I when I deploy, I do so in an assessment role. I don't do research on the local population. I would be closer to say that I, you know, do sort of micro research and a little bit of teaching for the Marines that I'm with. But I'm not sure whether I should be calling myself an anthropologist in that setting. You also have to ask whether or not there are non-research ways to answer the kinds of questions that anthropologists are being called on to answer in the field. There's a question of whether, if you switch hats in midstream, can you switch back? It would seem sort of inherently problematic for me to identify myself as an advisor when I'm downrange and then come back and present that material in a scholarly way, in a publication, or in some kind of a conference, as though I was secretly doing anthropology the whole time. This is not just an issue for those who deploy, but it is highlighted there. And again, you have that responsibility of making your navigation process clear to people. How is it that you're deciding how to identify yourself? And it strikes me that people who are doing applied work have a lot more experience navigating these kinds of positionality and role issues than we do, and particularly in areas where an applied role may end up overlapping with something that looks sort of vaguely like an academic role. And I think particularly about medical anthropology, educational settings, or development settings, but I'm sure that there are others, and I'm hoping we can talk about that a little bit in the discussion period. The last topic I have falls in the sort of where do we go from here category. As I said before, there's a lot that can come out of applied anthropology in terms of things that can enhance the discipline as a whole. I think this is especially true in situations where our work gives us access to communities that are not susceptible to traditional research. I work in an intelligence activity. I go to work every day in a building that we can't bring people into. That's not someplace where somebody's going to be able to go and do a year's of participant observation. Am I doing research while I'm there? No. But I am learning some things that probably would be valuable to bring out to the discipline for our own understanding of those parts of our society. But while there's been no formal action to exclude knowledge from applied anthropology, I think we've all experienced the fact that there is some discomfort or ambivalence on the part of our academic colleagues. And the knowledge that's produced out of applied anthropology still tends to be afforded a sort of second-class citizen status. I think the concerns of academic colleagues come from four interrelated issues. First, of format. You know, a report doesn't carry the same weight as an academic journal article. Questions about the underlying quality of scholarship. Questions about the condition of production. And questions about corporatization and militarization of the discipline. When work is published in scholarly venues, the first two concerns are easily addressed. The format's familiar, peer review is in place, and the scholarship can be judged in exactly the same way that it would be in any other kind of work. But the question about conditions of production remain. It's difficult to overcome those, to answer people's questions about secrecy, about bias, and things like that, because the disciplinary conventions for writing don't really afford it. If you think about a traditional journal article based on a grant from the National Science Foundation, those kinds of discussions are implicit rather than explicit in those publications. The discipline seems reasonably comfortable assuming that if you got an NSF grant and you're working from a university, that you followed IRB protocols, that you conducted yourself in an appropriate manner. And as a matter of fact, publishers would likely edit out any extended discussion of IRB, of informed consent protocols and things like that. And then, of course, you get taken to task for the fact that they're not there. But there is some reason for that, right? When you're taking a normal grant, we all kind of know the rules of that, and people are comfortable just letting it slide. When the knowledge is produced in a different set of circumstances, we do need to find some way of actually articulating that to academic colleagues who are not necessarily familiar with those contexts. I want to just quickly talk about the last issue because that is, I think, the more difficult one to overcome, which is I think some scholars have persuasively argued that there's a reciprocal relationship between anthropological practice and the frames and boundaries of the discipline. And we have certainly seen that, where advocacy and critique moved from being relatively small parts of disciplinary practice to being relatively large ones. And I don't think that we have any reason to believe that other forms of practice would not follow a similar trajectory. I don't pretend to know the answers to these four dilemmas, but I do think that the discipline has to ask itself in an era of diminishing tenure track positions, can it afford to lose the knowledge that the applied side of the discipline is able to produce? If the answer is no, we've got some collective work to do in terms of building conventions that allow us to report our knowledge. And we also have some intellectual heavy lifting to do in terms of how do you insulate the discipline from potentially distorting influences. Personally, I think the discipline is a lot sturdier than we give it credit for, but we do need to address those issues head on. Thank you. Robert?
Good afternoon. I'm Robert Rubenstein. I'm professor of anthropology and international relations at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. And because what I have to say resonates mightily with a lot of what's been said already, I'm going to try and keep my remarks somewhat telegraphic. To contextualize, I have been doing research and application of anthropology for the last 35 years. This is kind of scary to think about that. I started off as an educational anthropologist, looking at language acquisition. I moved into medical anthropology and somehow found myself embedded in military anthropology. The thing to say about that is that in every one of those cases, my shift from what I guess you might call disciplinary concerns to professional concerns came when my informants arrived with a metaphorical knock on the door and said, would you help us? You're studying something that's interesting to us, and we'd like you to try and apply that. So I worked with the Ministry of Education in Belize to improve their teacher training programs. I worked for the Atlanta Public School System. I've worked for the American Academy of Pediatrics, who came and said, we're interested in the new morbidity, and we see you've been studying hyperactivity. Perhaps you can help us deal with the increasing medicalization of behaviors that are non-standard, if you will. And then I began studying peacekeeping purely as a theoretical project, and at one point I had a knock on the door where folks said, look, you're studying culture. Surely you could help us do what we do better. Come and work on a harmonization handbook with us. Importantly, in each of those cases, the move to working in what I guess you would call the professional side, I'll just call it the applied side, because I'm not sure I buy this distinction. I think I've spent too many years talking to Saul Tax about the importance of interacting between theory and practice to really see this as a hard and fast distinction. But in each of those cases, I came in contact with the kinds of constraints that Marietta described and that Carrie described and Brian described in terms of the kinds of information that you can share or not share that you have access to for your research. And I want to say that I have for some years now thought that the developmental stage that in which military anthropology currently finds itself is quite analogous to the early days of the debates that went on in medical anthropology. So just like with business anthropology, though perhaps not quite as dramatically, I'm not sure I wasn't in those early points, there was a great deal of debate about whether it was reasonable or for medical anthropologists to actually serve biomedical practice, or whether that was something that was out of the bounds of the discipline. And I see this in military anthropology at the moment as well. There's a whole range of things that military anthropologists do. There's a whole range of things that medical anthropologists do. And yet somehow the cover term military anthropology is hard for the discipline to get its head around in quite the same way that it can get its head around that great heterogeneity in medical anthropology. So I have found that instructive. I also think that the issue, I should say that one of the reasons I'm going to be a little bit more telegraphic than I might otherwise is because I get to speak about some of these issues again this evening. And actually I'm surprised at how much of a resonance there is with the paper I'm going to be giving this evening. But I want to say that Rial talked about narratives and how those shape our sort of self-conception, and this is very important. One of those narratives, though, is one that Marietta spoke about, that we have dyadic relationships in research, and we have triadic or multiplex relationships when we practice. And I think that is an idealized narrative of our discipline. In fact, when we're in the field, we have multiplex relationships with commitments and constraints on our activities that mirror the kinds of things that. So I agreed with your analysis very much. I just want to push it a little more, or would want to push it a little more. But anyway, let me turn very telegraphically to 8 points that I see as common concerns between military anthropology and other applied anthropologies, and I hope that we can come back to some of these in the discussion. But first of all, there's the question of historical constraints. Clearly, anthropology's current engagement with the military is shaped in part by our past experiences. There's no need for me to repeat that history here, although I do think there is a need for some new and clear-eyed historical analysis that moves us away from the narratives that come too easily to our minds when we think about the past. But it does form an important context. Indeed, the history of our engagement with applied projects, both for the military and for other governmental organizations, is a context that's very important. Secondly, I want to say that it's important also to recognize that there's an interconnectedness among levels. It's not just that the policy is different, as Jessica says, and individuals who carry it out are sort of caught in that web. It's that what happens at these so-called lower levels on the ground can actually affect those policies. I've called this strategic or theoretical scaffolding in publications, and I think that it's important to recognize that those levels are interconnected. Third, military organizations, as we've heard today, are heterogeneous. There's no military organization, no institution in our society that simply reproduces what goes on at higher levels. In fact, these organizations are quite heterogeneous. Now, it might be that more accurate to say that within these organizations, there are groups of people who understand their tasks in different ways from other groups of people. I think of your various cultural models, Jessica. And this shouldn't be surprising to any of us as anthropologists. After all, our understanding of intracultural variation and the ways in which contrasting and sometimes even contradictory models of action coexist within societies should prepare us to accept that, to recognize it widely, and to want to speak in a more open and nuanced way about even troubling institutions or things that we think are troubling. So one of the things that's puzzled me for a long time is that anthropologists would never speak of many communities and institutions with a global and homogenizing phrases that we apply when we talk about the military. There is, in some real sense, no the military. There are militaries. Fourth, something about the misuse of anthropological concepts and data. This heterogeneity extends also to the ways in which our concepts and data are embraced, understood, and used. Now, some organizational members will embrace a dynamic, processual understanding of our key anthropological concepts, those like culture or norms or mental models or frames. But there are certainly many who will abuse those. And this brings us to this question of what happens with our information and can we control it? I believe the new revision of the AAA Code of Ethics enjoins anthropologists to ensure that their research is not used. Now, I find that a particularly puzzling injunction, since we have no way to control how something we write or publish eventually gets used 10 years, a decade from when we do it. So there's great variation in this, and some of this variation in how our information gets used is bad. But my fifth point is that this state of affairs is not acceptable because it leads to bad outcomes. I think it's important to recognize that the misuse of anthropological concepts and ethnographic data is potentially more harmful than ignorance of them. It follows for me that if we care about the positive contributions that anthropologists can make by changing the way programs on the ground work and by influencing policy, that we actually need to engage these institutions and individuals in constructive ways. Now, one of the historical circumstances that shapes anthropology's applied engagements is a trope of the cultural explanation of program failure. Now, over the past 20 years or so, I suppose this has been served as a post hoc explanation for why projects fail. It's happened in the failure of development projects. It's probably happened in the failure of business and medical interventions and so on. And I think it's what we're faced with now when the DOD has turned to anthropologists and said, oh, help us explain the failure of efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq. Part of it is the response with the trope of the failure to understand culture. Now, personally, I think that we have an obligation as anthropologists to try and act prospectively, and I guess that I'm beating a horse that's beginning to die if it's not dead yet. That is that we need to be doing things that are developing positive prospective understandings of these activities. Now, all of our attempts to do that might not work out so nicely. I personally demur from the value of the human terrain system and the human terrain teams, but it is an attempt to do something prospective, and at least on that grounds, we ought to engage it seriously. So sixth, to make change means engaging with military organizations, and we have to understand that there are a range of ways to make that engagement. Whether we're doing consulting with the military, we're working for business, working for any kind of organization, we can view our work along two axes. I think of it, one as a disciplinary or a theoretically driven axis, and one as the professional or institutional or goals. And those range in context from, I'll just label them with a set of words, that if you're moving from away from your concern with the discipline's goals or theoretical goals, towards the goals of the security state or business or profession, you can move from controlling the encounter, confronting the encounter, contesting the encounter, working in a complementary way, contributing, collaborating, or being complicit with it. So there's a lot of different ways in which we can engage, and we move back and forth among those different ways. The final point I want to make, or the penultimate point, is that change takes time. Whether one sees it as a reason for optimism or not depends very much on our perspective for the necessity for change. Someone who views anthropology's engagement with the military as merely supporting and reproducing imperial adventures, the idea that change takes time is going to be somewhat abhorrent. But if one accepts the idea that anthropological ideas about culture, relativism, transnational interdependence, for instance, are at core subversive to the hegemonic projects, then the kinds of engagements that we can engage in are quite reasonable, and some of them have been spoken about here. Finally, clearly, our work, all anthropological work, needs to conform to moral and ethical practices. And so the final point I would take up is the need for those who engage military organizations, just like every other anthropologist, to be sure that our work conforms to those moral and ethical practices. And just to point out that saying this is quite easy, but doing it in practice is a little bit harder, sometimes much harder. And this is because concepts like transparency, not harming our anthropological constituencies, not harming the discipline, are more complex than they seem at first blush. Since time my time's actually up, but my paper says my time is nearly up, let me just illustrate this briefly by saying that transparency is a value that we've all espoused, and yet unlike journalists who identify the people and places at which they're reporting, anthropologists typically use pseudonyms and may even legitimately resort to composite descriptions. And so it's fair to ask, is our history of our discipline one of transparency? As anthropologists, we all have special relationships to those with whom we work, our constituencies, yet who are those constituencies? Only the politically powerless? What if one studies or works with the military? As Jessica pointed out, those are the informants to whom she has ethical responsibilities. Similarly, and this is my final set of points, one of the objections often raised about working with military organizations is that doing doing so harms the discipline of anthropology by making access to those we study more difficult. I'll have a lot to say about this evening, but I just want to repeat that if you are studying organizations, having a discipline which denies the value of engaging a very important and widespread set of institutions that make a real impact for good or and bad, or for bad and good, on many people's lives, it's a little bit like anthropology putting its head in the sand. Thank you.
Okay, we ran a little bit longer in that part than we had intended, but we still have about 13 minutes for questions. What I'm going to ask, since from where I'm sitting, I can't really see you, is that if you have a question, just raise your hand and Brian will moderate.
Well, first, I just want to thank you guys for your presentations. It was one of the most stimulating things I've seen so far. A lot of the issues that I saw like brought up by everybody was the kind of differences between the applied anthropology and the academic, like the dyadic relationship versus like this more multiplex type relationship, and the issue of control, somehow having less control over our ideas from the applied perspective. But I want to know, do you guys think those are actually realistic like dichotomies? Because to me it seems like the academics have just as little control over what people do with what they publish as anyone else. In getting funding through NSF, you still have all these ties to all these different people who are invested in your research. So is there really this difference that like we see brought up?
I will just say very quickly that I think you're absolutely right. I think that most of these things that we talk about are differences of degree, not of kind. And I think that anthropology as a discipline has been good, and I think deliberately good, at mystifying itself, because that's the way we sell ourselves to many people. We go off to exotic places. We do things on our own. We come back. We tell stories. And the narratives that we've constructed for ourselves about how fieldwork is done don't help us when we confront ethical problems. So I didn't want to get into that, and none of the rest of us probably do either. But, I mean, if you are confronting a bunch of traditional academic anthropologists, all of who have done fieldwork in Papua New Guinea, I would challenge them to tell me that a lot of what they confronted in the field was much different from what we're talking about.
I had a question. Since this panel has someone who works for the Air Force and someone who works for the Marine Corps, I was wondering if there's any qualitative differences between like how receptive those organizations are to anthropology. The reason I say that is, you know, the Marine Corps, I know from personal experience, can be very hidebound, but at the same time, it prides itself on flexibility and has a long history of, interacting, sometimes heavy-handedly, but interacting in detail, you know, in counterinsurgency in various populations, whereas, you know, at least my personal stereotype of the Air Force, and one shared by my fellow Marines when I did my tour, is that it's very technophilic. You know, it's very about, you know, the missiles, the planes, broad strategic posture, but not so much interacting with various populations. So I was wondering if there were any differences in how receptive the two organizations were to anthropology.
Great question. If you told me 2 years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing, where I'm doing it, I would have called you a liar, because I was an Army officer, and I had the same impression of the Air Force that you do. I can approach this a couple of ways. Let me start by saying that that Air Force that you may have known is not the Air Force of today. The shift towards pilotless drones, aerial systems, whatever you want to call them, is enormous. The fact that there are not enough Marines and soldiers to drive convoys, so sailors and airmen do it. The fact that the Air Force is now an expeditionary organization are huge drivers in this. Now, every time I go into a classroom, there's a little part in the back of my head, the Army part, that says, they're going to tear you apart. They're going to say, get out of here, because we're Big Blue, and we do things differently. And the most encouraging experience I had was with a bunch of colonels who were going off to take group or wing command. So now, if they succeed, they may be considered for promotion to general, and if they fail, they will either be removed from command, or if they fail mildly, just be able to eke it out. So this is a big deal for them. And instead of telling us to get out, they said, can we have that tomorrow? And in pill format? We need it now. We don't have time to wait. So I think you're right that there are huge differences within the services, but I would just, again, go back to my closing comments. We need to be grounded in good ethnography, question taken for granted assumptions, and I have to do that every single day because I found huge receptivity in the Air Force, and as a consequence, I think from the education side, not the operational support, maybe not the policy, maybe not the training, but the educational side, the Air Force is really out front because when the Air Force wants to transform, they take a plane and they say, let's make it go supersonic without any sort of afterburners and do that, in stealth mode. And a bunch of smart people sit around the room and go, cool, let's do it. We're taking conceptual ideas and trying to harness that same Air Force mentality because they're facing it every day. The Navy is a different case altogether. So,
you're not suggesting that I work for the Navy?
No.
Okay.
I did.
Let me just briefly address that from the Marine Corps perspective, right? Not Navy. Well, you know what I mean. So, no, I mean working with the working with the Marines. Some of you may know this already, but I actually started this little trajectory down at the same place that Brian was, and then got kind of lured back north by the Marine Corps. And like Brian, I found that there are significant differences, but there are these internal discourses that you can leverage to make those doors open a little bit wider. You know, the Marine Corps adapt and overcome. You know, I mean that's very easy to work with. And they're
from the ground up.
Yeah, you had your minute. The other thing, too, that is that you can leverage the inter-service rivalries to a certain extent as well to see, you know, how the people are doing the programs differently, and that is a way of having the conversation about a difficult topic in a format that's familiar to people, that it's very easy for the Marines and the Army to tease each other. It's very easy for the ground forces and the Air Force and the Navy to tease each other. And it provides a context for having these discussions. So, but I've had very little pushback.
I'm currently an instructor at USASMA, which is the United States Army Sergeants Major Academy. I was hired last year to teach leadership to spouses. But when I looked at the program, I realized what they wanted was cultural anthropology. So that's what I teach every 2 weeks to a new group of spouses whose husbands are the highest of the enlisted that they can be. There's a huge change since the first OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, from training to education. And that at the Sergeant Majors Academy is what we are focused on. So I think that as anthropologists, we're missing a huge sector of education. There are no tenure track positions for the military education program. There are no huge benefits. Currently, I'm a contractor, so in June, my contract is up, whether it gets renewed or not. Well, I don't know, because the commandant changes every year, and commanders usually change every 2 years. So that huge turnover becomes a problem for educators to have that continuity. That being said, what I see happening, which really disappoints me, is the positions that should be filled by anthropologists are being filled by political scientists or economics professors or former professors or folks that have no idea what anthropology is. They've not been trained in anthropology, yet they profess to be able to do anthropology because they now have a PhD, which, not to diminish that, it's a fundamental difference. And I think that we're not addressing those issues. I think that we're not engaging the military where we need to engage them, which is not at General Petraeus level or when I briefed Admiral Mullen, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's at the leaders. It's at those lieutenants, those captains, those sergeants major who have the boots on the ground or are commanding where those drones are going to be put. Or for the Marines, they're first on the line. The spouses want cultural anthropology. Now the sergeants major are coming to my office and knocking and saying, are you going to teach this course for us too? Can we come in and sit in on it? That is amazing. That's a huge change for the military to switch from training to education. And I think we as anthropologists need to capitalize on that.
Oh, okay. I don't have a very articulated set of questions, maybe just some observations for discussion. And it seems to piggyback, I guess, off of Dr. Baba's points about professional versus discipline, et cetera. It seems that one of the questions I have, being sort of new to this discussion, is how all of you talk about playing roles or wearing hats or however you want to think about that. But it seems to me that it's the role of maybe thinking about us as integrated people. Do we talk about anthropology as a perspective? Do we talk about it as a worldview? Or do we talk about it as something that we learn and get PhDs in, et cetera, and then teach or what have you? And that seems to be a very, critical issue for me, because I think people bandy about these terms pretty openly, but all of you seem to be doing very different kinds of things. And so I just want to make a comment about that. And also, the other question I would have is, how do you define military anthropology? Is it anthropology of the military, or is it anthropology as taught and practiced or what have you within these organizations? And that, to me, seems to be taken for granted as an idea as well. And all of you seem to be doing, or many of you seem to be doing, or teaching anthropology within a military context, which to me is very different, because I come from a perspective where anthropologists actually study aspects of the military actively, and hence their relationship to it is very different. So I just had those as comments/questions.
I'd like to respond very briefly to, I think, both those points. First of all, as I said, I've been in the applied field since I got my PhD, and until very recently, I have never sold myself as an anthropologist. I have argued to myself and to others, I bring an anthropological perspective to the work. I think this whole debate that we're having right now through AAA and everything really revolves around the question that you brought up. What does it mean to be an anthropologist? We're not licensed. We're not certified. We're not credentialed in any way. Do you have to have a PhD? Is one undergraduate course in anthropology, does that make you an anthropologist? Can you be one without having any formal education or training? I think this is a question that we should put on the table and have some real serious discussion about. What does it mean to be an anthropologist? And just briefly, I think to some degree the whole notion of military anthropology is a label that's been applied to us rather than one that we have chosen for ourselves. I do anthropology of the military, and I also, I look at them as a research topic. And I also, again, bring an anthropological perspective to some of the problems that the military is dealing with.
Robert, I think you get the last word.
I want the last word, but I'm going to let you tag right on to it. The question of what is military anthropology is quite an interesting question, and I tried to signal in my remarks this idea that we should be able to hold together in a definition of a subdiscipline this wide variety of what people do, study, work for this whole range. And what's really curious to me is that although we don't have the press in other subdisciplines to mark off a section of practice to make it a marked category, we would like, some folks would like in military anthropology to somehow subdivide it and mark it off in two different ways. And I personally think that actually reflects the underlying ideological and political biases that were discussed earlier today. So we don't have time, but one last question. We've been told we have to go. I'm sorry. We'll do it outside.
Let's do it on the way out.
Exactly, yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No, they've got something else to be read in. So.